making some good progress. We're following an outline that has three major points to it. The first six chapters cover basically an explanation of Paul's apostolic ministry. The apostleship of Paul was called into question by some at Corinth, apparently, who were themselves claiming to be apostles, and their authority, they thought, ought to be regarded as high or higher than the Apostle Paul's, and they were teaching some things that were not in accordance with the will of God. So Paul is at pains in 2 Corinthians to show what a true apostle is, to explain what a real apostle does and ought to be doing. And so really the first third of this book, he explains that. And of course, we've been all through that this quarter already. The second major section of the book has to do with just a couple of exhortations he needs to give to the Corinthians before he gets there. He's writing this book to them from Macedonia. He's on his way in just probably a few weeks or months to be with them, and he needs them to correct a couple of things and get some things ready for his coming. So this middle part of the book deals with that. They need to straighten up some of their moral practices, not fellowship darkness, and then they need to follow through with this collection for the saints that they had already planned to do but hadn't done any follow-up. So he encourages them along that line in chapters 8 and 9. And then the last section of the book, again, he gets back talking about his apostleship and really contrasting it rather starkly with the false apostles that the Corinthians were dealing with. And he puts the Corinthians on the hot spot as far as how they had received these false apostles, how they had, in contrast, not perhaps accepted Paul's authority as they should. And he uses a good bit of irony, almost sarcasm, in chapters 11 and 12, especially as he deals with this problem. And he deals with it in an interesting way, as we're seeing and we'll continue to see this morning, in that he feels like he must boast about himself as an apostle, as an example of what a true apostle of Jesus would do and does, to contrast it with these false teachers, these false apostles who've elevated themselves among the Corinthians. So this is where we are. We studied under the section, Paul Must Boast. We talked about chapter 11, verses 1 through 15 in the last class period, that his selflessness excludes others from being regarded as apostles. And then this morning we'll talk about how his sufferings and his sacrifice would exclude these others from being regarded as apostles as well. In the end of that last section, he really, in no uncertain terms, nails exactly who it is that he's talking about and what the problem is. He says, you notice in verse 13, that such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into apostles of Christ. He says, and no wonder, for Satan himself transforms himself into an apostle of into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also transform themselves into ministers of righteousness, whose end will be according to their works. So that's how he sort of ends that section. And what we have then in verse 16 is a bit of a rewind. He comes at the same topic basically again and begins it just the same way that he did at the beginning of chapter 11. The first few verses that we'll look at here this morning, 16 through 18 or so, are very, very similar to what he said in the first few verses of the chapter, basically saying, I'm going to have to boast here. It's a foolish thing to do. It's a human thing to do. It's a fleshly thing to do, but I need to do it so that you can see the difference between what a genuine, valid apostle is and what an illegitimate apostle looks like. So this is how he begins. I say again, let no one think me a fool. If otherwise, at least receive me as a fool, that I also may boast a little. What I speak not according to the Lord, but as it were foolishly in this confidence of boasting, seeing that many boast according to the flesh, I also will boast. Whether or not they regard him as a fool or this practice of boasting as foolishness, Paul says, either way, you need to receive me. That is to receive me as an apostle and also to receive what I'm saying here with apostolic authority. Paul recognizes, firstly, that boasting like this is generally not what the Lord would have his followers do. There are a couple of different ways of taking this. When he says, what I speak not according to the Lord. There are some who take that to be similar to what he does in 1 Corinthians 7, where he says, you know, I've got some apostolic advice here regarding this thing. I don't really think that's what he's saying. I think what he's saying more rather is, what I'm doing here is not really what the Lord would have us do in general. It's not that, so generally we understand that it's not appropriate for Christians to go around boasting. There might be times when you need to tell somebody what you've done, and this is one of those times. I can't think is what he's saying. But generally it would be regarded as something that's not according to the teaching of the Lord. In fact, the Lord said not to do it. In Matthew chapter 6 and verse 2, when you do a charitable deed, do not, what? Sound the trumpet before you. You know, don't go around boasting about the things that you've done or are doing. And that's just a general principle that you see laid out in the middle of the Sermon on the Mount there in Matthew chapter 6. Paul's going to do this. And yet in doing it, recognizing it as folly, recognizing it as something that Christians don't typically do, he still expects the Corinthians to receive it and to understand what it is that he's trying to explain to them regarding the validity of his apostleship compared to that of the false apostles. So Paul reasons that the Corinthians are going to accept this because, first of all, so many others were doing it, and they were accepting that. See what he says in verse 18, seeing that many boast according to the flesh, I will also boast. So if you're allowing all of this boasting of these false teachers to go on among you, then surely you're going to accept what I have to say here. If you're allowing them to crow about, you know, their connection to the Old Testament, to Judaism, to the patriarchs and all of that sort of thing, if you're allowing them to boast about all of those things, surely you will allow me to say some things that are significant as well. So many others are doing it, and the Corinthians are putting up with it gladly. In fact, he says, in reading these next few verses, you put up with fools gladly, since you yourselves are wise. I want you to notice again the tone of irony, a little bit of sarcasm thrown into that. You know, the Corinthians are wise people, don't generally put up with fools very long. Okay. So he's being a little bit ironic and making this statement. You guys are so wise, you're so, you know, sharp that you just allow foolish people to come in and oppress you, cause you problems, violate your rights, and all of that sort of thing. He says, you put up with fools gladly, since you yourselves are wise, for you put up with it if one brings you into bondage, if one devours you, if one takes from you, if one exalts himself, if one strikes you on the face. To our shame, I say, we were too weak for that. But in whatever anyone is bold, I speak foolishly, I am bold also. So the Corinthians put up with these false teachers who were foolishly boasting. The idea of fools here, they put up with fools. That is, those who boast as Paul's fixing to boast. He's comparing, putting himself with them in that sense. Interesting description of these false teachers and their treatment of the Corinthians. It doesn't sound like this. What do y'all think about this? Does it sound like they were just like really nice people? Doesn't sound like it to me. I mean, in some ways, they could have used smooth speech and some of the things that we've talked about before that characterize false teachers often. But it also seems to me that they were aggressive and abrasive and arrogant in their approach to things. They were certainly boastful, and that's the point that Paul's making. But more than that, their leadership, if that's what you want to call it, was an oppressive one. It brought people into bondage. It took away spiritual blessings, I think, and even their own souls. It devours you, he says. They're taking from you. And that's where somebody asked me last week where I got the idea that these people may have been covetous and wanting things from the Corinthians. When Paul himself, remember, last week said, I wouldn't take anything from you. This is, I think, a place that indicates they may have been give us money because we're such great leaders kind of people, you know, Joel Osteen or something, that kind of attitude. So Paul says, you know, they're taking from you, they're exalting themselves, and they're even striking you on the face, they're abusing you. That, go ahead. Yes, I agree with that. And we noted last time, too, that there are some similarities between what was going on in Galatia and the problem there and what's going on with the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians. I think there's a bit of a difference, and I mentioned it last time, and we'll talk about it some more in just a bit as we get to it. Not in the character of the people who were doing it, not in the consequences of the false teaching that was going on, but the difference seems to me to be maybe in the nuts and bolts of the false teaching. It looks to me like the problem in Galatia was primarily Jewish Christians insisting on going back to the law. And here, while there may have been some of that, the elements of the false teaching seem to be related more to Hellenism, to, you know, paganism, really, that was widely accepted in Greek culture, even among Jews in Greek culture. So I think you see more of that here. We'll get to some of that in a bit. But I want to notice with you, you might flip over to 2 Peter chapter 2 with me. And as Peter describes false teachers there, you know, 2 Peter 2 is a great chapter warning us against false teachers. It begins in verse 1, there were false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you, 2 Peter 2 and verse 1. And then he describes their character, their activities, so much in here that relates to what Paul is saying in 2 Corinthians. But he mentions in verse 10, as he describes their character, especially those who walk according to the flesh in the lust of uncleanness and despise authority. Now that's these guys in Corinth, right? They didn't care about the authority of the Apostle Paul at all. They despise authority. And he goes on to say, they are presumptuous and self-willed. They are not afraid to speak evil of dignitaries. Verse 15, forsaken the right way and gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. There's that covetousness and maybe taking from the Corinthians, wanting money, that sort of thing. They are described in inglorious fashion in the next few verses. And then in verse 19, it says, when they promise them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption, for by whom a person is overcome, by him also he is brought into bondage. That's the exact word that Paul uses in 2 Corinthians to describe what those guys were doing, those false teachers in Corinth were doing. So you see a lot of the same characteristics, the quality of their character or lack thereof, and the effects of their teaching and their work among the people at Corinth. Other thoughts or questions or anything at this point? So what's about to happen is Paul is going to then launch again full force into some what one might be called boasting, or he calls it boasting, but a description of his willingness to suffer and sacrifice for the cause. And I just imagine that there could not be any clearer contrast to be made in the minds of the Corinthians. They knew Paul. Paul had been there for a couple of years. He probably visited again, as we've talked about. They knew him very well. And then they also obviously knew these guys that had come in and how they behaved and all of that sort of thing. And when Paul starts these contrasts, but here's how I am, and between himself and what these false apostles, how they behaved, I don't think there could be anything that would clear. And people, he's just trying to get people to think about this. You know, who do you want to follow? Who do you believe? Who's authoritative here? Who's acting like they're a minister of Jesus Christ? That's really his point. So let's go on in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. And notice in verse 22, verse 21, he says, to our shame, I say that we were too weak for that. But in whatever anyone is bold, I speak foolishly, I am bold also. So then he launches in verse 22. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they the seed of Abraham? So am I. Of course, Paul was all of those things, and he mentions that occasionally in his work when it was necessary and helpful to accomplish the work of God. Of course, he writes to the Philippians in Philippians chapter 3, verses 4 and 5, that he might have a right to be confident in the flesh. He says, if anyone else thinks he may have confidence in the flesh, he says, I more so. Circumcised the eighth day, of the stock of Israel, the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, concerning the law, a Pharisee. So he had, if you want to be, you know, a proud Jew, he had a lot to be proud of as a Jew. He says, that's not my purpose. That's not who I am. But if anybody wants to boast in their Judaism or their connection to the nation of Israel and the promises of God, he would have, Paul would have as much right to do that as anybody, more so, really, when you think about his standing. In fact, in Acts chapter 22, you might remember his defense on the stairs as the Jewish mob would have probably killed him had he not been rescued by the Romans. And he stops on the stairs, and there's a mob that's screaming, and he speaks out, calls for their attention. And it says in Acts 22 and verse 2 that when they heard that he spoke to them in the Hebrew language, and I just want to tell you that that might be something that some Hellenized Jews, say, in places like Corinth, might not could do very well. But Paul, you know, a lot of the common people, if they spoke another language, would speak Aramaic and then would learn Greek as a second language. That would probably be the most common thing in Palestine in the day, in the first century. But Paul speaks in Hebrew. That gets their attention, this mob of folks there. And he says in verse 3 of Acts 22, he said, I am indeed a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel, taught according to the strictness of our father's law, and was zealous toward God as you are all today. So Paul was truly a Hebrew of Hebrews, spoke the language apparently very well, well enough to get the attention of Hebrews who regarded it as a sacred language. And I want to share with you Albert Barnes' comment then about what Paul is saying here about himself, but also in comparing himself to these false teachers. Barnes notes this. He says, this proves that the persons who had made the difficulty in Corinth were those of Hebrew extraction, though it may be that they had been born in Greece and had been educated in the Grecian philosophy and art of rhetoric. And I think that's almost goes without saying from what we've seen already. He goes on to say, it is also clear that they prided themselves on being Jews, on having connection with the people and land from which the religion which the Corinthian church now professed had emanated. Their boast would probably be that they were descendants of the patriarchs, that the true religion had proceeded from them, etc. So I think that's a pretty good synopsis of the argument that Paul is making and what he's saying to us also about these others, what they were claiming to be. And Paul's, you know, the thing Paul's saying is, look, they can make all those claims if they want to, but I'm as much of all of that as they are, more so. So that doesn't wash. That doesn't make them, bottom line, he's saying, that does not make them superior to me. They may have all that. Even if they did, I'm right there with them or beyond them. Paul then goes on to boast that he has sacrificed and suffered so much as a minister of Christ, and much more so than his detractors. Listen to the way that he puts it. Are they ministers of Christ? Verse 23, 2 Corinthians 11. Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more, in labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequently, in deaths often. From the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes minus 1. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I have been in the deep. In journeys often, in perils of waters, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils of the Gentiles, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in weariness and toil, in sleeplessness often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness. Besides the other things, what comes upon me daily, my deep concern for all the churches. Paul certainly had sacrificed, other than Christ, maybe more than any other man living for the cause of Christ, and proved himself to be a true minister. The things that he mentions, first of all, in verse 23, he's more abundant in labors and stripes above measure, he says, in prisons more frequently, in deaths often. And the idea there is in the threat of death more often. Then really, that's sort of a general overview of some of the specifics that he's about to share with us concerning his willingness to sacrifice and suffer. He talks about, you know, in labors and strife, in prison and deaths. And so then he gives us examples of those that are a little more detailed and specific. Five times, he says, he received 40 stripes minus one. Now, probably most of us are aware that the Jews were not allowed by the Romans to put anybody to death. The most they could do was give a criminal 40 lashes, if you will, with a whip. But they usually stopped at 39 to make sure they didn't violate the Roman law. So it was 39 lashes. And often, of course, that whip would have more than one strand on it and be sort of a pretty brutal instrument, causing all sorts of damage and pain. I want you to think about what we know about the Apostle Paul. He had a lot of persecution in his life still to come. He is, you think about it, he's on this journey. He hasn't really even faced the long-term imprisonments and the problem that I read already in Acts chapter 22. That happens later, after these things are happening in Corinth here. So, or that he's mentioning that have happened already as he's writing to the Corinthians. So if you think about his life and you try to picture where to this point in his life, where has Paul received these beatings? I'm not sure that we have a record of any of those. If you go through Acts to this point in his life. But five times to this point, he'd received that most severe beating from Jewish authorities, somewhere, somehow. Three times he was beaten with rods. We have one record of that, and it's the record that's found in Philippi when he was there. Acts chapter 16, verses 22 through 24. The multitude rose against them. Magistrates tore off their clothes, commanded them to be beaten with rods. They laid many stripes on them. They threw them into the prison, commanding the jailer to keep them securely. Having received such a charge, he put them in an inner prison and fastened their feet in the stocks. So here's one place where he was beaten with rods, and also a place where he was imprisoned. That had been promised to Paul to begin with, and earlier to all of the apostles. This is going to be part of the deal, so to speak, that when men persecute you and kill you, they think they're doing God a favor. That's a great point, Freddie, that this had been prophesied specifically to Paul, that he was going to suffer many things for his name's sake, Jesus said to him. So he'd had these beatings with whips, beaten with rods, once stoned, and we do have the record of that in Acts 14 and verse 19 when Paul was at Lystra. You remember that Jews from Antioch and Iconium came there, and having persuaded the multitudes, it says in Acts 14, 19, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead. We read about stoning. Of course, Stephen was stoned, and we read about it here and there in the New Testament. Had to be just a brutal way to die. Hard to even imagine being stoned. And being stoned and surviving it is especially incredible. Paul survived that stoning in Lystra, lived to tell the story, as they say, but just unimaginable pain, I'm sure. The other thing we think about Paul is He says here he's three times shipwrecked. Well, we know of one time shipwrecked at the end of the book of Acts. But again, that was after he writes this. So three other times earlier, he's already, you know what? Now I realize traveling by plane is different than traveling by ship. But if I'd been in a plane crash three times and survived it, I don't believe I'd get on a plane anymore. You know, but Paul has been shipwrecked three times and he's still getting on the boat to go do the work of the Lord. That's somewhat amazing, really. Doesn't flinch at doing that. So he's travel in those days was especially precarious, was difficult and dangerous. And yet Paul goes ahead and does what needs to be done for the cause of Christ. And he talks about then generally the perilous journeys that he has. And I read that text in 2 Corinthians where he talks about perils. Some translations say in waters, and some of the newer translations say perils in rivers, which is actually the better translation. He talks about perils in the sea also in the same context. But the word waters there probably should be translated rivers. It's a word that means moving water. You might say, well, how are you going to be in peril in rivers? This would be a way. This is my friend Robert Chinyizi trying to cross a river this last week in Zimbabwe, where they've got all of a sudden quite a bit of rain. And the person that took that picture is Russell Nyambari. And anybody might remember what happened to Russell about 3 weeks ago in this river. He was bitten by a crocodile. So, yeah, you got perils in rivers for sure. and, of course, Russell lived to tell the story. And guess what? He's back crossing the river to go preach the gospel to a little village called Chitora in this area of the world. So that's the kind of thing Paul was facing. Same kind of thing that ministers of the gospel might even face today in some parts of the world. Perils in rivers, he says, and robbers, and you face that as well. I can't tell you how many stories I've heard even in modern times of preachers in foreign countries and traveling in foreign countries being robbed. Perils of robbers, his own countrymen, the Jews, the Gentiles, the city, the wilderness, everywhere he went, he was in peril. And yet still he goes to preach the gospel. And then he talks about his personal distress and deprivation. I want to look at verse 27 again. In weariness and toil, in sleeplessness often. We have the idea that forfeiting sleep is something we should never have to do for anything, right? But Paul did it willingly and often in order to minister the gospel. In hunger and thirst, he wasn't always getting his meals on time. And in fastings often, which suggests the purposeful abstaining from food or drink or both for a period of time for a spiritual reason. The Apostle Paul practiced fasting. The Apostle Paul says to us, be imitators of me as I also am of Christ, 1 Corinthians 11. Definitely a practice we should engage in. I'm not going to preach a whole lesson on that, but Paul, at this point, I should say, but Paul is somebody that practiced that. So you see, he's not in it for the Rolls Royce and the mansion and the big cathedral. That's not what Paul is about. He's not in it to receive glory from men. This exalted position that these false apostles apparently wanted to have over the rest of the Corinthians, that's not what it's about. He is willing to suffer immensely, sacrifice tremendously in order to glorify the name of God. So besides that, he's got a deep and abiding concern for, he says, all the churches. He has opened himself up as an apostle of Christ who's gone to all of these places he's been already and planted all of these churches. He has opened himself up emotionally to experience all sorts of concerns, love, sometimes anger at sin and problems that occur. But he's opened himself up to all of that. And you think about all the places he's been, all those churches of Galatia that he and Barnabas planted to begin with, and then, you know, where he's been at Philippi and Thessalonica and so many other places. And he's, you know, writing letters back as he's going along even now, writing letters back to these places that he's so concerned about. And besides all of those churches that he personally has planted, that he's constantly getting information from about how they're doing and how they're not doing, and he's so concerned about all of them, you might notice that he's also concerned about churches that he hasn't even visited. He writes to the Colossians about those, his concern for them who haven't even seen his face. He says in Colossians chapter 2 and verse 1, I want you to know the great conflict that I have for you and for those in Laodicea and for those as many as have not seen my face in the flesh. Churches he hasn't even been to yet. And he's got a great conflict in his heart for them as well. What about these guys in Corinth? What about these false apostles there? You think they cared? They didn't even care about the Corinthians, let alone about all the churches everywhere. Paul is showing the Corinthians his great compassion and love. His compassion and his empathy are the traits that then commend him. We go on and read the next verse or two. After he talks about his deep concern for all the churches, he says, who is weak and I am not weak? Who is made to stumble and I do not burn with indignation? I tell you what, when you have the care of people, you just only have to ask the elders of this congregation about that. There's a real emotional cost that goes with investing yourself in the spiritual well-being of another person or persons or churches. And Paul was paying that all the way along. He's feeling the weakness when others are weak. He's empathetic with them. When he sees people stumbling, as I said, it makes him mad. There's anger. He burns with indignation that Satan is troubling God's people, that a brother has fallen or purposely become unfaithful or whatever it might be. So his passion commends him. And then he says, if he must boast, his true boast is not in all of these things that he's talked about. And that's a tremendous list, if you will, a resume for an apostle that he's just given us. But he says, it's not in all this. Look at the way he describes it. If I must boast, I will boast in the things which concern my infirmity. You really want to know what I'd like to boast about? It's not all of this stuff that I've done, all the stuff I've been willing to suffer, all of these great accomplishments. That's not it. He says, my real boast is that I am so weak that I must rely on Jesus Christ to help me. And he does. That's my boast. That's my boast. And what a great lesson for all of us. Whatever we may have accomplished or not accomplished, it is God working in us that's the boast. That is what we glory in, not in ourselves, but in the fact that we need God's help to do anything, but particularly what he's asking us to do in our lives. So I think that's a powerful argument and a wonderful statement. He goes on and says, to give an example of what he's talking about, the God of our fathers, the God and Father, I should say, of our Lord Jesus Christ, who is blessed forever, knows that I am not lying. In Damascus, the governor under Aretas the king was guarding the city of the Damascenes with a garrison, desiring to arrest me. But I was let down in a basket through a window in the wall and escaped from his hands. Paul says, you want an example of my weakness? Now, he's going to give us another one in the next chapter. The other example of his weakness is what? The thorn in the flesh, remember, and he pleaded that God take it away, and God said, my strength. So we'll talk about that next class period. But here, this example of his weakness is, I don't know if you ever thought about how unheroic this is. I mean, Paul is not, you know, Luke Skywalker here. You know, he escapes by having some brethren let him down in a basket outside the wall. And I suppose when he gets to the base of the wall, he probably runs for his life to get away from Damascus. That's what he's describing. It's not some heroic thing that he accomplishes, but it's by the providence of God that he is able to escape by the skin of his teeth from Damascus. And so that's not some heroic thing to boast about. He ran for his life, basically, and had to be let down in a basket like your lunch or something, I guess. But that's almost embarrassing, I think is what he's saying. And yet, God enabled him to escape. Interesting note here. This is kind of an aside from what we're talking about. But I found this note. Farrell Jenkins does the best job of explaining this particular interesting thing. Aretas, who's mentioned in this text, was a Nabataean ruler. He's not, by the way, mentioned in the text in Acts, where this is described, Paul's escape from Damascus. But here he's mentioned by name. And Brother Jenkins says his rule extended from 9 BC to 40 AD. He was the father-in-law of Herod Antipas. In fact, I believe it was his daughter that was put away so that Herod could remarry that caused John the problem, John the Baptist the problem. So all of that's connected. In any case, he was the father-in-law of Herod Antipas. This chronological note lets us know that Saul's conversion was prior to AD 40. One of the things about these letters to the Corinthians is we do have chronological markers that help us, people want to know, how do you know that was in 54 AD or that Paul's imprisonment came, in whatever AD and all of that sort of thing? Well, there are some historic markers that we have time frames for, and one is the end of the reign of Aretas, which is 40 AD. That's well documented in secular history. Another is the reign of Gallio as a Roman proconsul in Corinth. When Paul was there on his first visit, you might remember he was brought before the judgment seat of Gallio, and we have an inscription that tells us when Gallio was there, so that we date that to 51-52 AD, right in that time frame is when Gallio was there. So we have some real good markers in his relation to the church at Corinth to know when his ministry was, and also in the Bible text itself, of course, it mentions how long he was there in Corinth, how long he was at other places at times. And so from all of that, we can put together a pretty good calendar, pretty good chronology of his work. Well, Paul has then labored in words tremendously here to demonstrate that he's an authentic apostle and that the Corinthians need to just stop listening to these false apostles who are abusing them, who are taking from them, who are trying to control them. I think if I were in Corinth at this time, and I gather that the Corinthians accepted this, that's your hope, of course, that they accepted this correction and that things were straightened out and these false teachers in Corinth were not allowed to gain the upper hand. But Paul's arguments here are compelling, and he'll go on with the same sort of argument in boasting, and really boasting in humility and in weakness in the next chapter, and we'll look at that next class period. Thanks for your attention this morning.